Today we've got questions on St. Christopher, Irish Monarchy, Republic of Venice, and the Royal Maundy Service. Welcome to another episode of Off the Menu, now being broadcast and podcast on the Crusade Channel. Talk radio the way it should be at crusadechannel.com. I'm your host, Vincent Franchini from Tumblr House, here with an insular, Charles Coulomb.
Insular? You mean as though I've been on islands?
Yes.
Like Ireland and Great Britain?
That's right.
Well, I have been. So there. What do you say to that?
How was that? That must be nice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's not Southern California, sadly, but it's great. Dublin, we started out in Dublin's fair city where the girls are so pretty. Didn't spend a lot of time there. But we went to Glendalough in the Wicklow Mountains, founded by the great St. Kevin. We went down to Cashel of the Kings and went up the Rock of Cashel and all that, which was really neat. Went to Cork. On the 4th of July, 1806, they put out from the Sweet Cove of Cork. They were loaded up top with a cargo of bricks for the Grand City Hall in New York. And the name of the ship was the Irish Rover.
Ah, okay.
Your man, McCann, from the banks of the Bann. They had Rusty McGurk, who was scared stiff of work.
All right.
What
I want to know, Charles, what I really want to know is, did you kiss the Blarney Stone, yes or no?
No.
I thought that was going to happen.
It was, but it was closed. The Blarney Castle was closed. And, you know, we had too many things to see, too many people to see. Then, if that weren't funny enough, from Cork we went down to Skibbereen.
Okay.
Now, you know, Skibbereen, and we ran by sheer coinky-dinky-dink, we came into the obscure rural place where Michael Collins was murdered.
Okay.
And from Skibbereen, we drove up the coast to Tralee and Kerry, the Dingle Peninsula. And from there, we drove up to the Cliffs of Moher and Doolin in County Clare. And we made a point of going to Spancel Hill. Now, this was 3 or 4 days into the trip, but my second morning in Ireland, I woke up and my first thought was, I've woken far from California, not far from Spancel Hill. Well, we went to Spancel Hill, which was really, really, really quite fine. But from Spancel Hill, we drove into the north of Ireland, into Tyrone, and we stayed out in the boondocks in order to see Roger and Kim Buck. And we spent a couple of days visiting with them. And then we went to Armagh and Downpatrick and Hillsborough Castle. Armagh is, of course, where the two primatial cathedrals are, Catholic and Anglican, the Anglican one having been Catholic. Hillsborough Castle is the king's residence in Northern Ireland. And from there, we went to Downpatrick, where we saw the grave of St. Patrick. Three saints went grave doth fill, Patrick, Bridget, and Columbkill. We'd already prayed. We went to St. Bridget's Well by the Cliffs of Moher, and that was really quite an experience. We did the five clockwise rotations praying around the cross and saw all of the different tokens that were left for St. Bridget and so on. We also went out to Kildare and saw another well of hers. And then we saw the National Shrine near Louth of St. Bridget. We drove down to Drogheda and venerated the head of St. Oliver Plunkett. And then we flew from Dublin to Edinburgh. Spent a day in Edinburgh seeing friends and walking the Royal Mile. Venerated the Shrine of St. Andrew in Edinburgh Cathedral. And then we went up to Dunfermline, venerated the Shrine of St. Margaret, and also prayed at the grave of King Robert the Bruce. From there to Stirling, overnighted in Stirling, and then drove all the way up to Inverary Castle, the Campbell stronghold of the Highlands, and then turned all the way around. Drove back down through the Highlands, through Glasgow, past St. Mungo's Cathedral, where he is enshrined, in a Presbyterian church as it is now, and then hit Carlisle, which is the northernmost city on the west coast of Britain in England. We went to Carlisle Cathedral and all that the next morning, and then drove down through the Lake District and saw Beatrix Potter's cottage, where she wrote Peter Rabbit. And I cut a rabbit's foot.
Yeah, you would.
What?
Yeah, for good luck, that poor rabbit.
It still had 3 feet.
You monster.
What?
You maim Peter a rabbit for life just so you can believe in a superstition.
It wasn't maimed for life. It was Peter Rabbit. It grew back.
I don't know if it works like that, Charles. They're not like lizards or something.
Yeah, they are. If it's Peter Rabbit, it does. I mean, any rabbit who dresses in human beings' clothing, walks erect, and speaks, in my mind, it grows back.
Would you do it to Harvey?
No, because Harvey's bigger than me. I mean, I could grab Peter.
But you'd have that much more good luck.
Yeah, let me tell you something. That paw would smack my face. You know, no thanks. I wouldn't fight Harvey. And as we found in the pre-show, I was disarmed by the cuteness of the Easter Bunny this year, so I couldn't grab for him. That left poor little Peter. He did ask me to leave him alone, but I wanted that good luck.
Okay. All right.
So from there, though, all kidding aside, though, it's a very pretty little area. And her cottage, Beatrix Potter's cottage, was very much reflected the woman herself. So from there, we drove down to Preston in Lancashire. And we stayed there for the Triduum, pre-1955. As offered by the Institute of Christ the King. And while we were staying there, we went out into the Yorkshire Dales, into the James Herriot country. And that was really beautiful countryside and interesting. We also went to Ley Manor, out where I think Pride and Prejudice or Sense and Sensibility, one or the other, was filmed. And then on Easter Monday, we drove as fast as ever we could down after the Easter Mass to Birmingham. We went to the Birmingham Oratory, and that was really, really wonderful. Venerated Sir John Henry Newman. And then we drove to Kensington, and we were in the outskirts of London for the next few days. We saw Windsor Castle, which was quite nice, and venerated Henry VI and Charles I and gawked at George III, who were all entombed in St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle. Saw the Tower of London and things like that. And then went out to Cambridge to see two of my godsons, one Indian, one Canadian. And then the Canadian godson and wife, we drove up to Walsingham. And that was really, really wonderful. Then drove them back to Cambridge. And drove to Reading. And we were spent a day in Oxford from Reading and saw the graves of Tolkien, Lewis, and Williams. And then the following and last day, we drove into the Chilterns to Beaconsfield field, and saw Chesterton's house and grave and the church he attended or would have attended had been built at the time. And then went down to Sussex and saw Belloc's grave and home. And then went to Gatwick and flew back here. I spent a fabulous week here. And then I left a week ago Friday for Dallas. And there was the conference for Kaiser Karl, which was on Saturday, but I was there Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It was a real wonderful, wonderful event. Really, really, really lovely time. Then I flew to London and took the train up to Stafford to meet up with the English-born Canadian godson and his Canadian wife. And we looked around Stafford and went to Lichfield and saw Dr. Johnson's birthplace and the cathedral. We went to Birmingham, and I again saw the oratory and all that, which was great. And then the following day, which was yesterday, or the day before yesterday, I went to Oxford, was interviewed on the new show for the European Conservative called Reality Check, hosted by my colleague Jan Bentz. And if that wasn't crazy enough, yesterday I left Oxford after a heavy breakfast, went to Stansted, and flew back home here. So those are my travels.
Reality Check with Charles Coulomb, huh?
Yeah,
I don't know
indeed.
If that's interesting. What's that about? What'd you talk about?
A lot of things, basically. We talked about the real nature of conservatism. We talked about re-enchantment and what it really means. We talked about the nature of Europe, all kinds of good stuff.
Cool. Where will our audience be able to find that as well? Do you know?
They'll be able to find it, I believe, on the European Conservative website. Let me see if there's any mention of it. Let me see.
So European Conservative, they have all their videos and content on their website exclusively, not YouTube?
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe so. I could be wrong. But while I was doing all of that, several interesting things were happening. One was the great eruption in Brussels, where the mayor of Brussels attempted to suppress the NatCon conference.
The what conference?
NatCon, Nationalist Conservative Conference, that was going on. People like David Engels and Viktor Orban, Rod Dreher.
He tried to suppress it?
They did. They sent the police in. They got two hotels. The first hotel that was going to host it, the city government pressured them not to. And then the second. And then they sent in the popo against the third to keep people from getting in. And they declared that the reason for this, the mayor, who was a radical Muslim, declared that the reason for this was that the delegates believed in, they had a conservative view of abortion, gay marriage, and so forth, and so were a threat to public order. So His Honor sent in the popo. Unfortunately for His Honor, this was a bridge too far, and even his prime minister threw him under the bus. And so they, the legal people who were the European legal experts, they were also represented. And they have a branch here in Vienna, a good friend of mine works for. But the
I mean, is that going to result in a civil lawsuit against the city?
I'm sure it will.
That's going to be a massive payout, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was stupid.
It was very stupid. I mean, it was so dumb. But, yeah, the highest court in Brussels has allowed a gathering of far-right European nationalist politicians to continue for a second day. Oh, far-right. But the Belgian prime minister wrote that there was no excuse for shutting it down. He said, what happened at the Clarge Day is unacceptable. Municipal autonomy is a cornerstone of our democracy, but can never overrule the Belgian constitution guaranteeing freedom of speech and peaceful assembly since 1830. Banning political meetings is unconstitutional, full stop. And this, you know, this, it was extremely funny. But the Orban, I say, was there. A lot of other folk were there. And of course, they got all sorts of abuse and ridicule by people like Politico and so forth. But the the sad truth of the matter is that this is going on all over Europe. In Poland, the new left-wing government there have been attempting to step on things. And of course, the problem for the European left is that you've got everything from discontent over the attacks on farming by the various governments to the continuing thing in the war. And of course, the easiest way to deal with all this stuff is simply to try to silence the opposition. You know, instead of addressing the problems that they're facing.
I thought everyone believed in democracy. I thought that's what we're touting. Democracy dies in darkness, right? That's what the Washington Post or one of those guys' motto.
Well, see, when you're an utter hypocrite and you have two ani that you speak out of,
yeah,
you know, no, I mean it's all crap. It's all garbage. But the problem, and they don't seem to see it, is that, number one, the problems that the so-called far right are talking about are real problems. Immigration, the low birth rate, the decay of marriage, abortion, contraception. These things are all either evils in the latter cases, or else they're things that will disrupt the body politic. Now, traditionally, and historically, if people are, if politicians are unwilling to deal with real problems, then people who will address them generally come to power. Now, that doesn't mean that the people who really address them are right. But, for instance, if you look at something like, everyone likes to quote, the Nazis coming to power. Well, the Nazis were addressing real issues that were affecting the Germans that the regular politicians in the Weimar Republic would not touch. So guess what happened? Because they wouldn't touch them, things were much worse than they would have been. And that, you know, in the meantime, there was also the Assyrian bishop who was attacked in Australia. You remember that? And there's total silence about that. Australia's e-safety commissioner, Julie Inman Grant, ordered Meta and X to take down all attack videos within 24 hours or face substantial fines. Will you ask about free speech again? What was that? Free speech? What? I mean, the you've got this hate speech case in Finland where this former interior minister has been attacked for quoting the Bible vis-a-vis gaiety. And so the government, she's been acquitted by two lower courts, but the government are taking her all the way up to the Supreme Court. I mean, so the legal folk who are defending her and who also defended the conference in Brussels is called ADF International, Alliance Defending Freedom. So you might look into them, ladies and gentlemen, the ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. But I mean, the assaults on freedom of speech for people of the quote-unquote right is it's a problem in the United States. It's a problem in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, parts of Latin America, much of Europe, because the ruling classes have their own vision of reality and their own vision of what constitutes heresy. And if you are a heretic, you will be punished.
So I wanted to touch on something that you said. So the mayor of Brussels, you said? Wait, is that what?
Well, a part of Brussels.
Part of Brussels. So you said he was a radical Muslim?
No, a liberal Muslim, oddly enough.
Oh, a liberal Muslim. Okay, yeah, okay, because I was going to say... Okay, because I was confused by that because I don't understand. Okay, because I was wondering, you know, are they socially liberal?
Well, no, but see, he's sort of the best of both worlds. He's Muslim, so he isn't Christian. And he's liberal, so he doesn't uphold Muslim social values either. Basically, he's a traitor to both Europe and his own people.
Good, good. That's how we like them. All right.
Yeah. I think so. But putting all of that aside, there have been several interesting commemorations this past week.
Okay.
April 16th was the anniversary of the Battle of Culloden, when the Highland clans went down to defeat. April 18th, which was Thursday, April 18th was the anniversary of Paul Revere's ride. Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. 'Twas the 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man who is now alive who remembers that famous date and year.
You know, that's one of the lines from Puritan's Empire I think I'll never forget, because I think you enjoyed the shock value of it, because you're talking about Paul Revere in the new paragraph immediately dealing with Paul Revere's ride. You state, quote, Paul Revere was detained early in the evening, like as if, you know, to totally myth bust, you know, bust open that myth. And there wasn't this great ride. Yeah, he was arrested pretty early on.
He was, but there were Dr. Warren and a couple of other people, you know, they continued it. But Paul Revere himself, he got picked up pretty early. And he did, however, learn the all-important question of whether the British were going to come over by boat across the Charles or march all the way around Dorchester Neck. And to this day, an Old North Church, on the 18th of April, they commemorate it. They have a liturgical thing. They shine the two lanterns in the church tower.
Yeah.
One if by land and two if by sea, and I on the opposite bank shall be. Now, of course, that the original church tower was knocked down in a hurricane or a big storm in 56. And so the rector of the place, the vicar of the place, the Reverend Mr. Peck, launched an interfaith crusade to restore the tower. And to commemorate it, this little limerick came up, which went, "Hickory, vickory, peck. The church tower fell on his neck. But St. Paul Revere will bless you, my dear, if you'll send the old vicar a check."
You know, it's so interesting. Something just occurred to me, which is that I feel like you are in favor of literally any tradition, even if, you know, if it's not true or it's based on something that you disagree with, but just the sort of the act of upholding the tradition and that custom living throughout the ages, I feel like that resonates with you in a special way.
Well, it's true. It does. I mean, even if, as you say, it's from a group or people I don't particularly like or agree with, because it's part of who they are. You know, and I mean to say, now I'm not talking about major things. Like I would not be happy to see Lenin or Stalin commemorated, but the French Canadians commemorate their days, like Saint Jean Baptiste. Other people should be allowed to commemorate theirs. You know, that's why I believe in. You know, those who are interested commemorating either the civil rights heroes or the Confederacy. Because people have their heroes and they have their martyrs. We'll set aside the fact that usually the one people's set of martyrs were made by the neighboring people's heroes and vice versa. we don't really have to dwell on that too terribly long. But it's true. I mean, believe me, you really become aware of that in Central Europe, without a doubt. But, you know, that's fine. That's fine, because it's all part of maintaining a group's identity and all that. I mean, take General Washington, for instance, okay? Now, as you know, the commemoration of George Washington is a big deal in the United States, right? First in war, first in peace, first in the hearts of his countrymen. The successful commander-in-chief of the Revolutionary Forces. The first president of the United States of America. Great hero, right? Well, if you're an Anglo-Canadian and a loyalist descendant, either factually or metaphorically, he was an oath breaker who perjured himself and was a traitor to his king and country. You'll have a different view of him. If you're a French Canadian, he's the man who started the French Indian War and paved the way for the destruction of New France. Which of these are true? All of them. They're all true. And they're all false. But much as the French Canadian in me doesn't really appreciate his acts with Jumonville, and much as the loyalist in me doesn't appreciate his perjury and treason, the American in me does indeed celebrate his role in the country's founding. And I also can't forget what George III said about him. When the news came to George III that George Washington, having really complete power now and an army behind him, gave it all up and went back to Mount Vernon. And the king's reaction was, if this be true, then General Washington is the greatest man of the age. Well, I think we need to show that kind of tolerance for, within certain limits, of other people's commemorations, you know, simply because we want our own tolerated. And we have to remember that what may offend us in other people's essential celebrations, you know what? Maybe ours offend other people. And if we expect them to tolerate what we do, well, I mean, again, It's like with the 12th of July celebrations in Ireland. If the Orangemen, I even though the Pope was in favor of it and supported King William's victory at the Boyne, I don't. Even though the Pope did. And, of course, the Orangemen like to shriek no popery and kick the Pope in boiling water and all that stuff, not realizing, because they don't know the history, that he was their ally. They don't know that. Nevertheless, if they want to be allowed to have their parades and wave their orange flags, that's fine. But they need to tolerate St. Patrick's Day. Contrary-wise, though, if my Catholic brethren in Ireland want St. Patrick's Day tolerated, well, they need to show a little forbearance to the Orangemen, much as it pains me to say it. I'm not a big fan of the Orangemen, frankly. One of the scariest moments of my life was a Memorial Day parade in Ohio, of all places. There were legions of Orangemen waving their sashes and red orange flags and stuff. I thought, my God, I had no idea the Midwest had so many of these people. But they did. Nevertheless, in a weird way, I'm glad that they're continuing to do it, because it means they haven't let everything be washed away under modernity, whatever that is. So, yeah, I mean, I think the whole thing with Paul Revere is a little silly, but I'm glad they're still doing it. Beyond that, though, that was April 18th. The next day, April 19th, which, although Patriots Day legally is the third Monday in the month, so that this year it was the 15th, but April 19th is the actual date of the battles of Lexington and Concord. And I always think of two things. One is the Concord hymn, with the lines inscribed at the bridge, the North Bridge at Concord. Here the embattled farmers stood. How does that go? Here the embattled farmers stood. Concord Hymn by Ralph Waldo Emerson, the great Unitarian thinker. Ah, there it is. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flags to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. But the grave of the British soldiers there, that has the inscription also by Emerson. They came 3,000 miles and died to keep the past upon her throne. Unseen across the ocean tide, their English mother made her moan.
The shot heard round the world makes me think of Schoolhouse Rock.
Yes, of course it does.
Your favorite, the history version of Schoolhouse Rock. No
yes,
more kings.
Is. No more kings slipping and sliding up to da, 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 over the horizon. What do we see? No more kings. We got to have a president. No more kings. He's going to do what the people want. Yes, indeedio. That's what I was brought up with. Schoolhouse Rock, No More Kings. Look it up, ladies and gentlemen, and rock out.
Yeah. I love Schoolhouse Rock. I love the multiplication one. That was my favorite Schoolhouse Rock.
What about Conjunction Junction, What's Your Function?
Yeah, yeah, that's good. The grammar ones are good. But the times tables are the best.
I have to say, though, I have to say that the 20th, the following day, was when the siege of Boston began. But it was also something else that was very important. Many, 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 many years later, in 1890, I think, thereabouts, It was the birthday of the greatest French-Canadian politician of the 20th century. The great, the amazing, the altogether wonderful Maurice Duplessis. So look him up, ladies and gentlemen. Maurice Duplessis. The stupid people of today, the double-any folk in Quebec, call his period Le Grand Noisseur, the Great Darkness, because the church dominated intellectual life and social life. And it was so awful. Ooh. They even had anti-communist laws on the books. Poor little stupid people. So sad. But I think our current time in Quebec history, the fruit of the Quiet Revolution, should be called La Grande Noisseuse, which is the feminine version.
What does that mean?
Well, Le Grand Noisseur would be the Great Darkness, but it's masculine.
Oh.
So what I'm saying is we should call the current period in Quebec, ever since and including the Quiet Revolution, La Grande Noisseuse, which is feminine. Walkery is feminine. Actually, it's not feminine. It's effeminate.
Effeminate.
Which is different.
Yes.
Yeah. Feminine is a real, natural, normal, and wonderful thing. Effeminate is not.
Oh, yeah. You don't have to tell these Father Ripperger fans about effeminacy.
I wonder if we could call the equivalent butch chicks emasculinate.
Emasculinate. Wow. I don't think so. I don't know if that works.
No, I mean, we need a word for it, and butch or dyke just sounds crude and vulgar.
I kind of like them. All right, questions.
Wait. We've got a big day coming up. Don't be so anxious.
Okay.
One more thing that has to be touched upon, and it's very, very important. In real time, this is April the 20th. Sunday will be the 21st. Monday will be the 22nd. April 22nd. Tuesday. Are you ready?
Ready.
April 23rd. And you know what that is.
No, I don't know what that is.
The Feast of St. George.
Mm.
Patron of chivalry, patron of cavalry, patron of the Boy Scouts, patron of England, patron of Portugal, Ethiopia, Russia.
Excellent.
God, St. George on the right. So it's a good day to pray for victory against evil and disgustingness everywhere. Good St. George on the dragon. But the next day is April 24th. That's Wednesday night. St. Mark's Eve. You've got to be very careful on St. Mark's Eve not to go to the churchyard. Because if you do, you'll see something horrible. The images of everyone who's to be buried in the churchyard marching in a sort of parade. So don't you be hanging around the churchyard on St. Mark's Eve. Badness may happen.
Isn't that happy, though? That's like the saints go marching in or something.
Well, that's if they're saints, but you take any group of people, there'll be a large number who aren't saints.
Oh.
This is just everyone is to die in the next year.
I see.
But that's St. Mark's Eve. The following day is the Feast of St. Mark, which in some places still has the processions, the greater litanies, which is sort of a countdown to the Rogation days.
All right. Is that it? Does that round it out?
Not quite. Because next week, as we know, how many days hath April? 30 days hath September.
30.
And the night of April 30th is Walpurgisnacht, which is sort of Halloween in the springtime. And all over the Central Europe, they light bonfires on Walpurgisnacht to disorient the witches on their flights to their Sabbaths. If that weren't bad enough, May Eve, it's also called, is the prequel to May Day, May the 1st. And here, in this very place next week, through my window, I'll be able to see the Maibaum that they'll erect for the town, the maypole.
Mm.
They'll be dancing around it, all that kind of thing. It's the month of Mary, Salem Water Marie, Salem Water Plus Beau. That is, it's the month of Mary. It's the most beautiful month. People will go a maying from Wales to Russia. So these are all good things to look forward to.
Agreed. All right. Can we proceed, Charles?
Well, I have a question for you.
Okay, go ahead.
As you sit there in your office high atop the Tumbler House Tower, and you look down at the little ants of Arcadia below, do you feel a rush of power or simply a desire to get to the first cabin after work?
Neither. A rush of power. I'm used to power. It's not a rush anymore. It's sort of like you're just there. And secondly, I don't go to the first cabin to get a drink, okay? We're quite well stocked in the tower, okay? I don't need to go out and associate with the plebeians down on the ground, okay? That's a silly question.
Let me tell you something. The first cabin. I can't believe you lack your local patriotism.
Oh, is that what it's... Okay.
Firstly, the first cabin, as you know, plays host to Arcadia's own, very own, band.
Yeah, the Priests of Love. I know.
Pat O'Brien and the Priests of Love every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. They've been playing there for years.
I know. We're very proud of the Priests of Love. I know.
Sadly, it's not a Smokey's anymore.
Right. Yeah, the... How did you hear about that? What, you went there and
went there. The
bartender?
Yeah, they all were very, very sad, but apparently the forces of evil have triumphed there too.
Yep.
It's weenieism once again. Oh, somebody somewhere might be having a good time. It's terrible. I want to punish them badly. I want to hurt them.
Yeah. The fun police.
We've got to take a stand against weenieism. I mean, it's just, earlier you said that I tend to like traditions of any kind. The reverse is also true. I tend to really dislike the killjoys. I mean, if you invite me to a 4th of July celebration, even though my adherence to the ideas of the Declaration is, shall we say, somewhat spotty, you bet. The fireworks, the barbecue, I'm there. I cannot think of anything worse than, you really should be having an outdoor barbecue like that. How can you celebrate freedom by wasting your time and eating?
Yeah.
The boundary between the weenie and the Puritan is difficult to discern. I mean, the Puritan will burn you at the stake, but he's still a weenie.
It's very true. All right, let's do some questions, shall we?
Oh, all right, I'm ready. I'm up to it.
All right, let's... So first question is from the Malibranch Davidian. I have no idea what that means, but that's pretty...
Malibranch was a French philosopher, 18th century. And the Branch Davidians, it's a pun. It, just go with it.
Oh, okay. All right, excellent. He says, could Charles please tell us about the form of government operated by the Republic of Venice? It would seem that this institution, in light of its longevity, prosperity, and influence as a Catholic state, tends to undermine the arguments for monarchism and lend support to aristocracy instead.
Well, not really. Because, number one, of course, Venice began as a tributary of the Byzantine Empire, like most of the quote-unquote republics of the Middle Ages did. So it was really, in the Middle Ages, what we call a republic operating within a monarchical framework was very common. Secondly, the Doge, which means Duke, the leader of the Venetian Republic, had to come from one of a small number of families whose names were inscribed in the Golden Book. You could call it an aristocracy, but they did have to obey the Doge. And an elected monarchy, like Venice or Poland, you know, it, to some degree it's an aristocracy, to some degree it's a monarchy, but it's really a mixture of both. We had discussed earlier, before the show, Aristotle and Aquinas's thing about the three kinds of good government and the best, which the three and the three kinds of bad government. Three kinds of good government were monarchy, aristocracy, ruled by the best, and what they call polity, which is basically ruled by the stakeholders, landowners, veterans, etc., the majority of them. In other words, people with a dog in the fight, people who either paid for everything or, you know, risked their lives to defend everything, that kind of people. So, according to Aristotle, and then, of course, each of these had their shadow, tyranny, oligarchy, and democracy, ruled by the mob. Now, they also maintained that the best kind of government would combine the three. And in the Middle Ages, this was seen primarily as being the king and the estates. So depending on where you were, if it were England, the king, the lords spiritual and temporal, and the commons. In some places, it was the king and the three estates, church, nobility, and commoners. And then other places, it was the four estates. Church, nobility, city dwellers, and rural people. But what we have done today, of course, which I think is very special, is that we've created a mixed government of the three worst kinds, which neither Aquinas nor Aristotle ever even spoke about.
You've touched on this before, and one of the points that you make, which is so interesting, I was reminded about when you talk about polity, and polity isn't simply everyone gets to vote, or it's not a town hall meeting per se, but you get a little bit more specific, and you say it's a stakeholder, you have a dog in the fight, et cetera, et cetera. That reminds me of when, what are you talking about? Bond issues, I think it was?
Yeah.
Bond issues. And that impacts, that's from people who own property, right? Yeah. That impacts people who own property. And basically, you make the point that you've got people who are voting basically money out of the hands of other people.
Yeah, which is called theft.
Yeah. Now, the. Is there any country in the world that sort of practices in a better way where only stakeholders get a vote?
Not at the moment.
That seems so strange to me.
What's that? That no one does that anymore?
I mean, that if you don't, like for example, like if you don't pay taxes, if you haven't paid taxes, if you don't have a job for, you know, the past 10 years, why are you voting on what we do with our taxes?
Because it's fair.
You didn't put in at all. Like, what? I don't get it.
Well, no, but it's fair.
I mean, that's like, you know, I get to vote on what, I don't know, let's say what Google does. You know, I get to vote in a shareholders meeting, but I'm not a shareholder.
Well, no, you don't get that right.
No, but it's, I don't know. It seems like it would solve so many different problems.
Well, it would. Unfortunately, and of course, it was the requirement. It was the requirement at the time of the American Revolution. Yeah. The colonial assemblies, you had to the specifics varied, but you had to pay taxes up to a certain amount, or property up to a certain amount. Be a professional of some kind, and there were places that connected full citizenship to military service.
Yeah,
it varied, but see, universal suffrage became the big deal in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, and now no country is allowed to call itself a democracy unless it practices universal suffrage.
Everyone was complaining taxation without representation. That's like we got representation without taxation.
Well, that's very true. And, of course, you could make the argument that everybody should be able to vote on sales taxes because everybody pays those.
Okay.
But that's the only tax I can think of that's like that.
Yeah.
If you're not paying any income tax, I don't think you should be able to vote on things that would be financed with the income tax. Although, of course, there's the question of the constitutionality of income tax in and of itself. Well, you know, it was considered illegal before the amendment 1912 that permitted it.
Illegal on what basis?
Because the Constitution bans confiscatory taxation. And so the 1912 amendment had to be passed. What had happened was that, as an emergency measure, Lincoln imposed income tax during the Civil War. Afterwards, it was challenged in court and found to be unconstitutional as the Constitution stood. So they had to pass an amendment to the Constitution in 1912 to permit income tax.
Fascinating.
Well, we know better than those stupid people over the past.
Well, where's the Schoolhouse Rock episode on that?
Well, it's called Milk Them Cows. And you see a bunch of government people saying, "Milk them cows. We got to take every drop. Milk them cows." The citizens got to cough it up. Milk them cows. Till the pips squeak. Milk them cows.
Oh, man.
That's the what we should do is claim there are a whole bunch of Schoolhouse Rocks that were never released. Schoolhouse Rock's dirty little secret. And that would be the first one, Milk Them Cows. A payee to the income tax. I told you my idea of a user-friendly motto for the income tax.
What?
Income tax. Choosing to share.
Oh, yes. Sharing is caring.
Caring, yes. Sharing is caring. See, and you show you care for the least fortunate by paying your income tax. And if you have the slightest resentment at paying your income tax, you're not caring.
You know, okay.
It shows you that the founding fathers were not caring. The fact that they banned the income tax shows you that they were not nice people.
You know, there is a celebrity who said something really annoying lately. Really big mainstream celebrity. It's like, oh yeah, I'd love to go back to 1830. Love to do that, except, you know, without all the racists and arranged marriages. And that just rubs me the wrong way in such a big... That just really...
I'd like to be in the present without all the dead babies.
Of course.
You know, I'd like to be in the present without the dead babies and the rainbow flags everywhere.
Yeah.
And the euthanasia. I'd like to be in the present without the euthanasia. And I'd like to be in the present without the fake news and the suppression of truth and reality. Other than that, I'd like the present to be just the way it is.
I know. All right.
No more kings. We got to have us a president. No more kings. He's going to do what the people want. No more kings. What?
Sketchy. All right. Anita says, greetings, gentlemen. As we teeter on the brink of Holy Week and Charles tours the Three Kingdoms, it seems like a good time to talk about Irish royalty. What is the history of the native Irish monarchy? Are there still survivors of the last ruling Irish dynasty? Who, if anyone, is the rightful, if uncrowned, King of Ireland? Have the crown jewels of Ireland or any other relics of the Irish monarchy been preserved?
Woof. Well, Gaelic Ireland, the kings, Tara of the kings. Well, in Gaelic days, before the 1100s, all of Ireland owed allegiance to the High King at Tara. But, there were five provincial kingdoms. Meath, which was the domain of the High King, the plains of Royal Meath. Then there were the kingdoms of Ulster, Munster, Connaught, and Leinster. Now, every one of these were divided further into sub-kingdoms. And so, there were a lot of kings and kinglets in Ireland. But the four major provincial kings, in Ulster, it was O'Neill. In Connaught, it was O'Connor. In Munster, it was O'Brien. And lastly, but definitely not leastly, in Leinster, it was McMurrough Kavanagh. All of these four great houses have descendants yet. Ulster is Dom Hugo O'Neill in Portugal. Connaught is the O'Connor Don at Clanada's house in Roscommon. Munster, O'Brien is Lord Inchiquin, formerly of Drumoland Castle. And then McMurrough Kavanagh still hold forth at Boris House. Here is the thing, though. From time immemorial until the 1000s, the O'Neills were successively High Kings of Ireland, Niall of the Nine Hostages. But then Brian Boru of Munster became the High King and for a while it was with the O'Briens of Munster. And then, sometime, I don't remember when, it passed the O'Connors. And during a succession dispute in the 1100s, one of the O'Connor claimants to the high kingship called the Normans in from England under Strongbow. And that was the beginning of the end of Gaelic Ireland. And that was the end of the high kingship. And the system became so chaotic and bizarre that the Pope, Adrian IV, granted Ireland to the King of England, Henry II, as Lord of Ireland, with instructions to settle the state and church. He did, and he brought over a lot of Normans to pacify the country. But they ended up becoming Gaelicized. And so families like Fitzgerald and Fitzroy and so forth became totally Gaelicized Normans. And the English control of Ireland dropped down to the area immediately around Dublin that they called the Pale. And it would stay that way until the Protestant Revolt and the attempts of Henry VIII and then Elizabeth and finally James I to defeat and suppress the Irish lords, which they were able to do because they were inevitably fighting each other. There are many, many descendants of the Irish kings and chiefs of name. I just mentioned you the four big ones. Now, as far as relics go, they're more geographical because, like the Lea Fall in Tara, where the kings, the high kings were crowned, is still there, as is the Dún Rock in Donegal, where the O'Donnells were crowned kings of Tyrconnell. But there aren't, per se, Irish crown jewels. There were up until the early 1900s. But then something terrible happened. They weren't crown jewels in the sense that you're thinking of. In 1783, King George III created a new order of chivalry that would be appointed by the king, and it would rank with the Order of the Garter for England and the Order of the Thistle for Scotland. And this was called the Order of St. Patrick. Its motto was Quis Separabit, which to this day is the motto of the Irish Guards. It means, who shall separate us? And in fact, you'll see it just barely on this keychain, which is the badge of the Irish Guards. You can see the shamrock, and around it is Quis Separabit. Well, long and short of it is that, like the other orders of knighthood, it had there's a very impressive jeweled collar and all that for the monarch as Grand Master of the Order. And it was this jeweled collar, etc., of the Order of St. Patrick. It was referred to as the crown jewels of Ireland. But in preparation for King Edward VII's visit in 1909, they were stolen, and they have never been recovered. Yeah. And that was the end, unless somehow they're still around, of the crown jewels of Ireland.
All right.
Are you looking at a picture of them?
No, I'm not. Crown Jewels of Ireland.
Crown Jewels of Ireland. The Irish Crown Jewels. They consist of a star decorated with Brazilian diamonds. It's
Are diamonds?
Yeah. Featuring an emerald trefoil and ruby cross on a blue enamel background, a diamond badge, and five gold jewel encrusted collars. The insignia comprises 394 jewels, mostly from Queen Charlotte's jewelry.
394 jewels of diamonds? I mean, that's what it looks like. Know what I mean? Like cuts of like pieces of diamonds.
It's true.
That's unbelievable. And that's just floating somewhere?
Yeah, we don't know, or unless they were broken up and sold. The jewels have never been recovered, and to this day they remain lost and the mystery unsolved.
That's unbelievable.
The curious case of the Irish crown jewels.
Wow. Okay. I didn't expect it to be that spectacular.
Why? Because it was Irish? I thought it was going to be junky?
I mean, well, because...
Oh, well, you know.
Well, I mean, because everyone always talks about the British crown jewels, so you know, it's natural to assume there it'd be like a step lower. I would think that if it was that grand, that there's some sort of... Yeah, I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for it, but you'd think there'd be more mystery in surrounding it or something like that.
There is. There's huge mystery surrounding it.
No, but I mean, like, well, I guess people just don't talk about it as much.
Well, no. I mean, why would they? They don't know about it. But it was a... So 1907 is when they vanished. You can see the Marquis of Londonderry in full gear.
Yeah.
Of the Order of St. Patrick.
All right. Thank you for that, Charles. All right. Next question is from Jared, who says, I hope you both had a blessed and joyous Easter. I have a question for Charles regarding the Royal Maundy service. Did any other European monarchies, aside from Britain, celebrate the Royal Maundy service or something similar? If so, has this tradition been maintained in any of the other remaining monarchies? Now, also, just for my benefit, what's a Royal Maundy service?
Not telling.
Oh.
No, Maundy Thursday, you know, is the day in Holy Week in which the Last Supper is commemorated. And the Royal Maundy service takes place on Maundy Thursday. Originally, the king would wash the feet of a certain number of poor men and the queen of poor women, and they would give them a banquet and money. And then in the 18th century, they got rid of the actual foot washing, but they kept the banquet and the giving out of what's called Maundy money. And there's a church service attached, so that's called the Royal Maundy. Well, to answer your question, it was just about universal in Catholic monarchies. The kings of Spain and France, Portugal, England, Scotland, Hungary, Poland, Naples, Sardinia. And the reason for this is that the washing of the feet had a very particular meaning for Catholic monarchs. Because, you see, going back to the Last Supper, in addition to starting the Blessed Sacrament and the priesthood, Christ united his kingship, his Davidic kingship, which he was the rightful inheritor of from King David. He united that with the communio of the church. And from that time, most particularly from the 300s, when you began to have Catholic monarchies, Catholic kingship was seen as participation in the kingship of Christ. So the Maundy Thursday foot washing became a big, 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 big thing at every Catholic court. But it was gotten rid of in France in 1830 with the deposition of King Charles X. In Portugal, with the deposition of King Manuel II in 1910. In Sardinia, it was gotten rid of when the main line of the House of Savoy died out in 1831, was replaced with the liberal branch, which would end up doing the whole Risorgimento. In the Kingdom of Naples, it was continued until 1860. King Baudouin of the Belgians did it. It was maintained in Austria-Hungary until 1918, and in Spain until 1931, when Alfonso XIII was driven out. So now the only country where it takes place, to my knowledge, is in fact Great Britain, and without the foot washing element.
Man, that royal Mondi service, that potentially kills a lot of birds with one stone. I'm flooded with all these different Charles-isms. So one of the things you said, which is that politicians should have this sort of one aspect of their service should be sort of this humiliating aspect, something where it's like you have to sacrifice something, right?
A public spanking.
Something like, yeah, well, very outlandish. Yeah, like a public spanking.
All presidents and prime ministers should have an annual public spanking in which they're humiliated.
Well, okay, so instead of that, you know, this sort of thing, I feel like is perfect for people who have these egalitarian principles, if they actually have them.
Well, nobody really has egalitarian
principles. Nobody really does, right? Like,
no, they're just yapping away.
I'm egalitarian until I'm in power, and then my foot's on your neck for a boy.
Right.
Yay! Power to the people! Freedom!
Right. But it really just goes to show you the hypocrisy and just it's all talk. Because that would be the perfect... You know, it's so funny, too, because it even is a good PR opportunity. You know, like, oh, wow, look at he's washing their feet, et cetera. But, nope, just can't be hassled.
And, of course, Dame Guéranger, as always, to be consulted on just about everything, he makes the comment on about Maundy Thursday and the Kings that I think is worth looking at. Because, I mean, ultimately, it's a reminder that that humility is what is at the bottom of the Christian kings, the office of the Christian king. Let me see. Yeah, here it is. We occasionally find kings and queens setting this example of humility. The holy king, Robert of France, and later St. Louis, used frequently to wash the feet of the poor. The holy queen, St. Margaret of Scotland, and St. Elizabeth of Hungary did the same. The church, with that spirit which makes her treasure up every recommendation of her divine Lord, has introduced this act of humility into her liturgy, and it is today that she puts the great lesson before her children. The bishops throughout the world follow the example set them by the sovereign pontiff, who performs this ceremony in the Vatican. Yea, there are still to be found kings and queens who on this day wash the feet of the poor and give them abundant alms. Now, there was a book called Curiosities of Popular Customs, which I heavily recommend, which is just what it sounds like. It's a Curiosities of Popular Customs by William S. Walsh. Goes into enormous, enormous detail about all sorts of things. It says its subtitle is Curiosities of Popular Customs and Rites, Ceremonies, Observances, and Miscellaneous Antiquities. It talks about the foot washings celebrated in Vienna by the Emperor of Austria, and at Munich by the King of Bavaria, are held in the royal in the royal palaces of the respective sovereigns. And it also, it goes on in great detail about the way it's done. It also talks about how the King of Spain does it, the King of Portugal. And that that is an annual, how do I put it? That was an annual expression of really what was best in Catholic monarchy. Now, there was a similar thing, of course, in that in Catholic monarchies, the kings and the emperor would march in Corpus Christi processions. And another ceremony that was common to most of the courts of Christendom was the presentation of gold, frankincense, and myrrh to the Chapel Royal at the Epiphany. And you can see why in each of these. Corpus Christi was, of course, honoring the Eucharistic King. The Epiphany is emulating the three kings of the Orient in adoring our Lord. You see, mm-hmm. because Christian kingship was seen as a reflection of the kingship of Christ. I have no doubt, frankly, that if there had been, by the time the Feast of Christ the King was brought in 1926, there were very, very, very few Catholic monarchies left. But I have no doubt that had it happened 100 or 200 or 300 years earlier, the Feast of Christ the King would have become an integral part of the royal calendar in many Catholic countries.
All right. Final question for this episode is from Marianne, who says, "Dear Charles and Vincenzo, what's up with St. Christopher? What's this I hear about him having the head of a dog? Why did everyone used to have a St. Christopher medal? Is it just me or does no one do that anymore? Thank you both. Off the menu is my Chicken Soup and Comfy Slippers podcast."
Well, it's just you. Don't feel bad. No. The dog head thing speaks to St. Christopher's fidelity and loyalty to the Christ child, which is why he was seen as looking like having a dog's head in some renditions. You'll still find St. Christopher medals. I was kind of surprised when I was in Lichfield in England a couple days ago. I saw a building that had, in continental Europe, in Catholic Europe, in normal buildings, you'll often find on the, you know, just a building as you're walking down the street, will have the Blessed Virgin Mary or the crucifix or a saint sort of embedded in the wall. Well, this random building in Lichfield had St. Christopher embedded in the wall. So a medieval survival. But no, smart people still pray to St. Christopher when they travel. Stupid people don't. But then stupid people do or don't do a lot of things that are stupid because they're stupid people. There was a concerted attempt to go after St. Christopher in the wake of the Vatican Council. And when they were redoing the calendar in 69, they tossed him off it, which the stupid, of whom there are always a lot, both in church and state, declared he had been desainted. Not true. All that happened was that his feast day was taken off the general calendar. But because it's the feast day of St. James of Spain, who's the great patron, Santiago Matamoros of Spain, and the bigger deal. But if you belonged to a place or an organization to which of which St. Christopher was patron, the Mass could still be offered there, and his feast still observed. And, of course, if you observe the traditional Mass, then it's still the Feast of St. James with a commemoration of St. Christopher. So don't be afraid to get that St. Christopher medal. Don't be afraid to pray for him if you have to travel. One of the things I thought was kind of interesting is that in the book The Children of Green Know by Lucy Maria Boston, a statue of St. Christopher comes to life and drives off the evil witch and her minion.
Mm.
So, pray to St. Christopher, honor St. Christopher, keep his day, and don't listen to the morons.
Always solid advice.
Yeah. Morons could use their mouths sewn shut. Morons of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your brains.
All right. That's it for this episode.
No.
Your ode to spring is going to have to wait, Charles. Sorry.
Not the ode to spring. Not the ode to spring, but I think we do need a poem.
Okay, a poem of reasonable length.
Reasonable length.
Reasonable length. And by reasonable length, I mean less than one page.
Okay.
So I think your 500-page ode to spring is disqualified.
That won't do it. All right, fine. I concede that. But, given the date, given the time, here we go. Paul Revere's ride.
Okay.
Listen, my children, you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, if the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the North Church Tower as a signal light. One if by land and two if by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be, ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm. Then he said good night, and with muffled oars silently rode to the Charlestown shore. Just as the moon rose over the bay, where swinging wide at her moorings lay the Somerset, British man of war. A phantom ship with each mast and spar crossed the moon like a prison bar, and a huge black hulk that was magnified by its own reflection in the tide. Meanwhile, his friend through alley and street wanders and watches with eager ears, till in the silence round him he hears the muster of men at the barrack door, the sound of arms and the tramp of feet, and the measured tread of the grenadiers marching down to their boats on the shore. Then he climbed to the tower of the church, up the wooden stairs with stealthy tread, to the belfry chamber overhead, and startled the pigeons from their perch on the somber rafters, that round him made masses and moving shapes of shade, by the trembling ladder, steep and tall, to the highest window in the wall, where he paused to listen and look down a moment on the roofs of the town and the moonlight flowing over all. Beneath in the churchyard lay the dead, in their night encampment on the hill, wrapped in silence so deep and still that he could hear, like a sentinel's tread, the watchful night wind as it went, creeping along from tent to tent, and seeming to whisper all is well. A moment only he feels the spell of the place and the hour, and the secret dread of the lonely belfry of the dead, for suddenly all his thoughts are bent on a shadowy something far away, where the river widens to meet the bay, a line of black that bends and floats on the rising tide like a bridge of boats. Meanwhile, impatient to mount and ride, booted and spurred with a heavy stride, on the opposite shore walked Paul Revere. Now he patted his horse's side, now gazed on the landscape far and near, then impetuous stamped the earth and turned and tightened his saddle girth. But mostly he watched with eager search the belfry tower of the old North Church, as it rose above the graves on the hill, lonely and spectral and somber and still. And lo, as he looks on the belfry's height, a glimmer and then a gleam of light. He springs to the saddle, the bridle he turns, but lingers and gazes, till full on his sight a second lamp in the belfry burns. A hurry of hoofs in a village street, a shape in the moonlight, a bulk in the dark, and beneath from the pebbles in passing a spark, struck out by a steed that flies fearless and fleet. That was all. And yet, through the gloom and the light, the fate of a nation was riding that night. And the spark struck out by that steed in his flight kindled the land into flame with its heat. He has left the village and mounted the steep, and beneath him, tranquil and broad and deep, is the mystic, meeting the ocean tides and under the alders that skirt its edge. Now soft on the sand, now loud on the ledge, is heard the tramp of his steed as he rides. It was 12 by the village clock when he crossed the bridge into Medford town. He heard the crowing of the cock and the barking of the farmer's dog, and felt the damp of the river fog that rises when the sun goes down. It was 1 by the village clock when he galloped into Lexington. He saw the gilded weathercock swim in the moonlight as he passed, and the meeting house windows, blank and bare, gazed at him with a spectral glare, as if they already stood aghast at the bloody work they would look upon. It was 2 by the village clock when he came to the bridge in Concord town, and he heard the bleating of the flock and the twitter of birds among the trees, and felt the breath of the morning breeze blowing over the meadows brown. And one was safe and asleep in his bed, who at the bridge would be first to fall, who that day would be lying dead, pierced by a British musket ball. You know the rest. In the books you have read how the British regulars fired and fled, how the farmers gave them ball from behind each fence and farmyard wall, chasing the redcoats down the lane, then crossing the fields to emerge again under the trees at the turn of the road, and only pausing to fire and load. So through the night rode Paul Revere, and so through the night went his cry of alarm to every Middlesex village and farm, a cry of defiance and not of fear, a voice in the darkness, a knock at the door, and a word that shall echo forevermore. For born on the night wind of the past, through all our history to the last, in the hour of darkness and peril and need, the people will waken and listen to hear the hurrying hoofbeats of that steed and the midnight message of Paul Revere.
Wow.
And even though I don't think much of Paul Revere in real life, and even though I'm a good old Tory, I must say it's a very stirring poem.
That was the most, of all your poem readings, that was your most animated reading, by far.
Well, it's a hard vision, you know. Now, of course, when they say, have him go, the British are coming and all that, it's not what he would have said. And, of course, he never made it to Lexington and Concord. He was already arrested by them. There are a lot of inaccuracies in the poem. But it was something, even in my day, that a school child was supposed to memorize. And Paul Revere's ride was an iconic thing. I mean, that's why today Paul Revere's house in Boston is still a national shrine of sorts, as is the Old North Church and every other place on the Freedom Trail. So while I might wish that the Union Jack were in the canton of our flag instead of the stars, nevertheless, it's a part of what we've inherited. It's a part of our national identity. And so, you know, just as the British will tell you, honor the Light Brigade, honor the charge they made. Paul Revere's ride was an important moment in our history.
All right. Thank you for that, Charles. Now that we're up in what?
What? You didn't want to hear the other poem.
No, not the other poem.
Sally Leibowitz's ride.
No. Sally Leibowitz. No, I'm not going to even ask. That's okay. We'll get to that next time.
Or not.
All right. Now that we're up and running, I can proudly ask if it's Monday.
Off the menu.
And what about the soul you save?
I would say, after due consideration, after traveling through the Three Kingdoms, after returning here to Austria, after seeing members of the Imperial family in Dallas, Texas, I can say, honestly, truthfully, it may well be your own.
See you next time, everyone.
Ciao, ciao.